Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
A warning that this story looks at sorcery accusation-related violence, sexual assault, and torture. In a rural village in Papua New Guinea's Enga province, a crowd gathers to mourn the death of a young boy. Suddenly, a woman in the crowd clutches her throat. She has a respiratory disease and hasn't taken her antibiotics, and she can't breathe.
She was gasping for air, and when you are suffocating and gasping for air, your eyes will be engorged, they'll be very red.
The crowd turns towards her, and instead of helping her, they watch with fear.
So she was gasping for air inside the people in a group where people were mourning, and then people turned around, hey, this lady is doing something here. They accused her, like, you must be the sorceress. Because you try to change, like, you know, morph into your true form or something. So they held her, tied her up, tortured her.
In pockets of Papua New Guinea, accusations of sorcery ripple through villages. It usually starts when someone gets sick or dies. And often, an elderly or vulnerable woman is blamed. Then comes the torture and, too often, the killing.
They kill women and children in a cruel way. And it is the very people and the clan or the tribe that you depend on and are the very people that, you know, you try to be good to will one day turn against the woman.
It sounds like a barbaric practice from ages past, but research has shown that it's a modern problem, one that the Papua New Guinea government is well aware of. But survivors say it's not the politicians who show up. It's the brave doctors, bishops, and women who risk their lives to save others from being branded as sorcerers. Hi, I'm Scott Whitey, and this is a new season of Polytalk, where we'll take you behind the scenes of Pacific politics and how it shapes our lives. Today on Polytalk, from brutal accusations to a national action plan, you'll hear from the survivors who forced a reckoning, and the question hanging over PNG, why does the violence keep happening? When Monica Paulus was in her 30s, her marriage had broken down. So she returned to her home province of Simbu in Papua New Guinea. Back to her father's house, thinking it would be a place of safety.
I went back home and I lived with my father. And I had the brother after me. We all lived in the same house.
One afternoon after coming home from shopping, Monica's father collapsed. He was having a heart attack and died almost immediately. And in the midst of the shock and grief, her own brother accused her of sorcery.
What went through my mind was like, I couldn't believe what I had. And all of a sudden, like, fear just crept into me. And, like, I was also shocked.
Word of the accusation spread quickly, and Monica could barely process what was happening.
To flee my home for safety, it's the worst thing I've ever felt in my life. Like, after being having problem with my marriage, and then I have to leave my children and move, thinking that my home was the safest place and my family were the safe nets that I should fall back. And then now that I have spears coming from them, I was just not in the right stage of mind to think right at the time. I was also, like, living in fear. I was also living in shame. There was so much that I was going through.
Already vulnerable as a divorced woman and knowing what can happen to those accused, Monica fled for her life.
I fled with a friend of mine who is also from the same village. She lives in Leh, so she was so nice to me, and she said, you can't live here, we have to go. So I went with her, and we lived in one of the settlements in Ley.
While living in the settlement, another accusation spread, this time about a young woman who had been raped. People said she had bitten her attacker's tongue, but the story twisted into something else. They said she was a sorceress.
And in that same evening, they dragged the woman to one of the fields, and they started questioning her and throwing stones at her. No one stood up to help this woman. And everyone just, you know, turned against, even her family, everyone.
Monica watched as the woman's family and her community turned on her.
I was standing there and I saw it with my own eyes. And that was the time that I had a drive in me that if I can't stand for myself and if I can't speak out, there will be more women being killed in that way. And I said, if the people who are supposed to help, like the government and the army and also like the educated people at the university and students, no one stood up for her.
That moment changed Monica's life. She became a human rights activist, co-founding both the Highlands Women Human Rights Defenders Network and Stop Sorcery Violence.
It's a network of human rights defenders from the Highlands provinces. Most of our focus is more on, you know, responding to sorcery accusations and helping those who need to flee danger related to sorcery accusations and all this.
Through this network, Monica and her colleagues have developed a life-saving system. Sometimes all it takes is a single phone call.
They'll call us, but if they don't have enough units on their phone, they could give us a missed call like 3 times. Then we know that there is a danger somewhere, so we quickly try to find a phone credits and top it up. And the human rights defender in the village is also playing a very risky part of the role. So what he or she does, he cannot respond like talking. She has to go out to a hiding place somewhere, into a toilet or something, and start texting. And we only contact by text.
Using whatever information they can gather, they draw maps, brief police, and launch rescue missions.
We describe the place, and we have to draw a map and give it to the police, and the police goes in and goes straight into that house and break open the house and rescue these 5 people in there. They were in the house. And that was one of the success stories.
She says they've saved between 500 and 600 people this way. But every rescue carries enormous risk.
I had a case where, back in my village, when they were trying to kill some women, and we have to work closely with the daughter and through phone, and we saved this woman. We saved about 5 women and their children. And from the time, like, they knew I was doing that work, so they came back and started questioning me, like, you want more people to die in the village by saving the sorcerers and all this.
The violence, she says, doesn't just take lives. It tears families apart.
They kill women and children in a cruel way. And it is the very people and the clan or the tribe that you depend on and are the very people that, you know, you try to be good to will one day turn against the woman.
And for Monica, that pain is personal.
Like, I've never talked for my case. I've never talked to my brother ever since, up until now. We've never come close together face to face. So it's a very sad thing.
Monica's story began in the Simbu province, in the rugged heart of Papua New Guinea. But if you travel north and deeper into the highlands, the road climbs higher, the air gets cooler, and the mountains close in. Here in Enga province, sorcery accusations are just as common and often even more violent. It's where Dr. Raymond Kipakapu works at the Catholic-run Yampu Health Center. He's a doctor who treats survivors of these attacks. And what's remarkable is that he once believed in sorcery himself.
I used to believe these things growing up. My parents talk about it around the fire.
We talk about it every time during the day. I mean, we're happy to talk about it during the day, but we get really scared when we're talking about it in the night.
He grew up with a belief in Sanguma, the local word for sorcery or black magic, and with stories about a spirit that goes out to steal and eat people's hearts.
So we still have beliefs like, you know, when you go to a visitor's house, you don't sleep looking up, you know, don't expose your chest. Someone might remove your heart. And then, you know, our belief system, every time we bury a dead, we always keep watch around the grave. There's a superstitious belief that, you know, those people who practice witchcraft, they might come and remove the dead body under the ground. It's deeply rooted. They still believe in it. Everyone does in Enga.
When Dr. Raymond finished high school, he left Enga province and moved to Papua New Guinea's capital, Port Moresby, to study medicine. And although he'd grown up around the superstitions of sorcery, he'd never seen what happens to a victim who's been accused, then tortured, until he returned to Enga as a doctor.
A week into working here after my induction and all that, we had I think, two cases that were brought in.
One patient was a grandmother who'd been blamed for the malaria death of a grandson. And at first, Dr. Raymond's superstitions took hold, afraid of what the woman might be.
I had to lead my team as a doctor to do the ward run. So my belief system, my perception, my upbringing took the best of me. But when I went into the room, I saw the old lady and another young woman. They melted my heart. I also took courage and comfort in my staff, the nursing officers and the CHWs that were with me. So this wasn't their first rodeo, but it was mine.
The grandmother had been badly burned, and as he treated her wounds and spoke to her, he realized that the story her village had concocted about why she was a sorceress didn't make any sense to him.
I've come to realize that when we are confronted with this kind of the sorcery issue, the most common mistake that our people make is they ignore logic. Yeah. And then the most obvious evidences are completely ignored and they choose to believe the superstitious, the supernatural component of things.
While Dr. Raymond no longer believes in sorcery superstitions, he still has to deal with the horrifying consequences of them, treating the many people, mostly women, who are brought to his hospital after enduring days of torture.
If the victim is kept for a day or two and tortured, then it's really bad. They have third or fourth degree burns, which are very deep. They can be bent down to their digits, like the fingers. They cannot grasp things. We have to assist them with this, that sometimes we go and feed them. One of the commonest practice of their torturing is genital mutilation. Heat up the metal rods and then insert it into the woman's private area. Yeah, so it's really bad. Sometimes it really gets nasty.
A study by the Papua New Guinea National Research Institute found that historically, in Enga province, the causes of illness and death were attributed to a ghostly malice, but that witchcraft was a foreign belief for other provinces.
Before in our past, we didn't disrespect people, we didn't mistreat people, and we respected the tradition that was there. Due to the road connection and modernization, I think people were moving around, and then they brought in stories.
In 2010, newspapers in Papua New Guinea started reporting that the narrative around the sickness and death had changed. Instead of a ghostly malice, now sorcery or sanguma was being blamed.
With the sanguma belief, they said, if you bend them, the spirit will come out, it will start talking, or they will confess. So torture until death. If they don't confess, they die. If they confess that they've done it, they die. Beliefs like that slowly crept in.
And those beliefs are found across the entire country. For decades, Papua New Guinea's laws around witchcraft rested on the Sorcery Act of 1971. It didn't just recognize sorcery, it allowed someone accused of killing a witch to claim it as a defense. That law was finally repealed in 2013, a big symbolic step. But not enough to stop the violence. 2 years later, the PNG government launched what's known as the Sorcery and Witchcraft Accusation-Related Violence National Action Plan, or SNAP. Dr. Fiona Hukula was an original committee member for the first national plan.
So this national action plan brought together quite a wide group of stakeholders from government, from civil society. The government was involved from the beginning, which really showed the commitment to trying to at least address this issue, but also recognizing that it's a form of violence that needed to be responded to because of the reoccurring incidents that were happening across the country.
The plan had 4 main goals: to support survivors, to prevent accusations before they happen, to prosecute those who commit the violence, and to keep learning through research and community outreach. Fiona was at the forefront of this research.
So the research really was looking at how, what kinds of ways or mechanisms were in place, both at the very local level, but also through the legal system, the government system, on how to address these accusations.
Over a period of 4 years, Fiona studied what had happened inside village courts and how police responded to sorcery accusation-related violence.
It was a very stressful time, to be honest. We ended up dealing with people wanting help, saving people, and it ended up being quite a big stress.
But in Papua New Guinea, where data is often lacking, she says the research she was able to collect was incredibly valuable.
Because we were able to engage with village courts and police, it was important research to be able to understand some of the challenges that they have. Because a lot of the violence, especially in the provinces, is happening in rural or quite remote areas, which means it's hard for police to get out there. It's hard communication-wise. And sometimes accusations happen, the violence happens, and it's after that police are informed.
She says that one of the strengths of the National Action Plan was that people who were part of it worked hard to make sure the issue stayed on the government's agenda.
One of the things, and I think the strength of that National Action Plan, the original plan, was that it brought people together and people who were really committed to the cause. One of the other things that really stood out for me was there are a lot of amazing Papua New Guineans who are defending the rights of people, who are saving many women and families who have been accused and who have suffered from violence.
But despite the awareness the plan brought to the issue of sorcery accusation-related violence, she says that not enough resources were provided to help police and grassroots organizations do the work they needed to do.
They have to find vehicles to go and rescue people. You know, they use their own resources. Some of these human rights defenders I know bring these survivors to their own houses while they try to get them to a safe house.
On paper, it was strong, a vision for Papua New Guinea free from sorcery-related violence. But over the 10 years it was in place, it was criticized for a lack of funding, slow rollouts, and concerns that very few perpetrators had ever made it to court. Instead, grassroots advocates like Dr. Raymond Kipakapu believe it is the local communities, churches, and women survivors who take on the work of trying to fix this problem.
Our community advocates, particularly the Catholic Caritas program and Caritas group, have been a very proactive group in mobilizing youths to go out into communities, training them to advocate, also in rescuing victims, desensitizing communities, you know, telling them that this is not right.
And over 2 years, Dr. Raymond has been back working in Enga. He says the community work has seen positive results.
When I came in 2023, I think over the year, our record was 13 cases over the year. So just like, you know, 1 or 2 cases per month. But then last year, I think we only had 2 cases.
But this, of course, means perhaps fewer people are surviving these attacks. Local and international academics estimate that on average, 6 people are killed each month in PNG because of sorcery accusations-related violence. And from where Dr. Raymond stands in the wards of his provincial hospital, the government isn't doing enough.
Been getting good help from the police, but the Department of Government that's responsible for organizing, coordinating us and providing direct support to us has not been helpful much in our province, at least.
In 2025, the PNG government's Department of Justice launched a new national action plan to combat sorcery accusation-related violence. Politok reached out to the PNG government's Justice and Attorney General for an interview, and we sent questions in writing to the department's Deputy Secretary, Josephine Pitmore, about why the first national action plan had failed, why politicians weren't turning up for those on the ground, and how this new action plan is different from the first. But we have not received a response. So while the laws exist and the action plans are written, why, after all these years, reports and task forces, does the sorcery accusation-related violence still thrive in so many parts of Papua New Guinea?
My name is Gabriel Kuman. I'm a senior lecturer at the Tewenuat University.
Dr. Gabriel Kuman has been studying this issue and says it's not about belief, it's about development.
I see it as a development issue. As people move from traditional past to the present time, and given the changes that have been happening, many of our people left their traditional past so quickly that they found it difficult to adapt to the modern times and changes that are happening. So social changes have been happening so fast that many of our traditional systems have been breaking down.
In his research at Divine Word University, Dr. Kuman argues that modernization in PNG, roads, towns, schools, and the cash economy happened faster than the community could adjust. The result is a kind of social whiplash, the collapse of village leadership, loss of kinship safety nets, and widening inequality between those with jobs and those left behind. In that vacuum, old fears rush back. And when something goes wrong, a sudden death, an illness, people look for someone to blame.
I'm from Simbo, and Simbo is the place where sorcery accusation and killing is so common. I have seen many people who have been accused of sorcery and tortured in front of the public. The village leaders, they can't do much because they are powerless before the eyes of the youth. The youths are very rough and it's very difficult to control them.
Dr. Kuman's study describes how unemployment and poverty have created a new culture of violence in the highlands. Young men disconnected from land and tradition now act as enforcers of superstition. When a relative dies, especially someone educated or wealthy, they look for answers that development has failed to give them.
So many Papua New Guineans leave their homes and they go to live in towns and cities for work purposes. And their lives are not healthy. They feed on store goods and this can contribute to disease, lifestyle diseases that lead them to die at an early stage. And when these educated people die, people back at home rely on them for support. So when they die and brought their bodies are brought back to the villages. The youth and the people start to look for the causes and they accuse innocent people. And most of these innocent people are old men and women, widows and widowers.
It's a tragic feedback loop. A lack of services, no clinics, no doctors, no basic health explanations, which fuels fear. And that fear justifies violence. He says this cycle shows how uneven development has deepened the belief in sorcery. The government's failure to deliver roads, schools, and healthcare has pushed many rural communities to rely again on spiritual explanations and on so-called glassman, traditional diviners who claim they can see the cause of a death. And for years, glassman have operated in the shadows. People pay them to identify supposed sorcerers, and their accusations can spark torture or killings. And that's why in 2025, PNG passed what's called the Glassman Act, a law making it illegal to profit from accusing someone of sorcery. human rights groups called it a breakthrough, the first law that directly targets those fueling the violence. But Dr. Kuman says legislation alone won't solve the problem.
The current law on Glassman and Glassmary, which is very good to minimize the situation. But that's not the only way to address the issue. For me, I see this as a band-aid solution.
He says that without broader reform, education, livelihoods and local leadership, people will keep turning to superstition. Dr. Kuman warns that poverty and corruption have eroded public trust. Village chiefs no longer have power. Police are under-resourced and politicians are only seen at election time. He argues the result is disempowered communities where mob rule replaces law.
It requires a collective effort, working with the people in the villages, strengthen leadership system in the village, partnering with the police, the churches, community-based organizations and international-based organizations. Collectively, we can work together to address this issue.
It's a vision that echoes his conclusions that sorcery-related violence isn't an ancient curse. It's a symptom of uneven development, political neglect, and the slow unraveling of community life. And until government delivers real services, roads, education, health, leadership, people will keep looking for answers in the dark. Politalk is hosted by me, Scott Wydeh. Our producer is Kuntamari Crofts. Our supervising producer is Jordan Fennell. And our executive producer is Faleanga Fulu, Inga Stunzner. Next week on Politalk.
Allied bombers have been homing in on Iraq's heavy concrete bunkers, trying to destroy the rest of Saddam Hussein's air force.
In 1986, a Marshallese teenager named Russell Langreen signed up for the US military, chasing an education and a promise of the GI Bill. But instead, he found himself in the middle of Operation Desert Storm.
And I was there, sitting in the desert thinking, what the heck am I doing here? I joined up for the GI Bill. I didn't join up to shoot somebody. It makes you grow up quickly.
He survived the war and he did his service. But when he went home to the Marshall Islands, he discovered something shocking.
PTSD for islanders, soldiers or military veterans are really bad. And they have absolutely no help.
He realized that Marshallese veterans like himself didn't have access to any veteran services.
No help or no... No counseling service, nothing that we can access that could help us.
40 years after the Marshall Islands won independence, its defining deal with the United States, the Compact of Free Association, still shapes every part of life, from who gets to serve to who gets left behind.
Negotiations between two countries that have a sort of a David and Goliath-like relationship. It's an incredibly uneven, unequal political relationship. So one member of this so-called partnership was a rising imperial superpower, and the other was its former colony.
So what did COFA really give the Marshallese, and what has it cost? In the next episode of Politalk, we dig into the deal that bound two nations together, and the Marshallese veterans still fighting for help.